DW Deutsche Welle. Worldlink.
Welcome to DW's Worldlink. I'm Neil King, speaking to you from Bonn, Germany. On this week's programme, we'll be taking stock of how Turkey has changed 1 year after the failed coup. We'll also be finding out why a growing number of Muslims are living in fear in India. And we introduce you to a unique virtual reality project that tries to humanize warring factions.
Only when both of them are answering, you can realize how similar they are. So instead of trying to fix a conflict, why don't we go back to the basics? And if you can bring back humanity, to some extent you stop the war.
All that coming up on Worldlink. You're listening to DW's Worldlink with me, Neil King. 1 year ago, on July 15th, Turkey was in turmoil. A coup was launched by parts of the military against the government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The coup, which Erdogan immediately blamed on the rival Islamic Gulen movement, failed. Tens of thousands of people were rounded up and jailed, including many academics and journalists. As Erdogan's purge continued, relations with the EU hit rock bottom. The West looked on with concern as Erdogan grabbed even more power after narrowly winning a key referendum that converted the country from a parliamentary to a presidential system. Today, Turkey is more divided than ever. Dorian Jones caught up with some Turks in Istanbul to take stock of how that fateful night in July has changed the country.
Soldiers trying to overthrow the government, opening fire on unarmed people on the night of the failed coup. Over 240 people died and nearly 3,000 were injured when a faction of the military attempted to seize power. Mehmet Akyol chats with his family. He still bears the scars of July the 15th, as well as the memories.
The soldiers took out their rifles and started shooting. At that moment, I totally lost it. I was so furious because I wasn't expecting anything like this from them. I went down to the street. I was just about to lift my arm and shout at them, and then I saw blood running down my wrist, and I noticed that my wrist was shattered. But I felt proud. I would have been devastated if I hadn't gone out onto the street. My children would have questioned why I hadn't tried to take a stand during this terrible situation.
This video of the events showing soldiers killing people in cold blood is all over the media, along with interviews of those who resisted the soldiers. But for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his government, it's not just about remembering the sacrifices of the people, but also galvanizing support for the ongoing post-coup crackdown. Turkey remains under a state of emergency. Over 60,000 people have been jailed and more than 140,000 purged from their jobs. Many are accused of being members of FETÖ, the name given by the government to followers of the US-based Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who is blamed for the coup. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim underlined the importance of the ongoing crackdown.
Ana muhalefetin, adalet adı altında FETÖ'cüleri.
The whole world should know this. This struggle will continue until there's not a single FETÖ member left who has not paid the legal price of their betrayal. There's no doubt we have to take further steps in the fight against the FETÖ terror organization. The struggle will continue with determination. What I want from my nation is for it not to lose faith in the struggle and to continue supporting us.
That appeal for support comes as the government is aware of mounting criticism over the crackdown and accusations that it's simply trying to silence its critics. İşte Gözaydın is a law professor and says she's paid a big price for the events that night.
Actually, it was life-changing. A week later, I was suspended from the university because what I did was retweeting some of the very peaceful tweets, including being against capital punishment and to call the government to be in accordance with the rule of law.
Gus Aydın is one of more than 6,000 academics who've lost their jobs in the ongoing purge. But that was just the beginning.
In December, I was detained and then arrested. The allegation is being a member of an armed terrorist organization, so it may be up to 22 years. I'd have no predictions for the trial, as being somebody who's been educated in law. In normal circumstances, I would say that I would be acquitted. However, we're not in a period of rule of law. It depends on the political climate. It's not just, that's for sure. It's absurd and not just.
According to Gus Aydın's lawyers, the only evidence against her is a television interview she gave in which she argued that only a court can determine whether a person is a terrorist or not. There are tens of thousands of similar cases. The crackdown has killed the rare cross-party unity that prevailed in the days following the failed coup. Last weekend, over 1.5 million people rallied in Istanbul, calling for justice and an end to emergency rule. The main opposition leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who organised the protest, has been labelled a terrorist supporter by President Erdogan. Kılıçdaroğlu says Turkey's experienced 2 coups since July the 15th.
Bu yürüyüşle Türkiye'de adaletin olmadığını, demokrasinin kan kaybettiğini.
After the coup attempt, there was a big consensus for democracy amongst the people. But on July 20th, when the state of emergency was introduced, there was a civil coup. And that led to a series of negative developments. Politicians and journalists were arrested, academics were dismissed from their positions, 140,000 civil servants were fired from their jobs.
In the euphoric days after the defeat of the coup, there was a window of opportunity to start healing Turkey's deep political divide. 1 year on, that window is firmly closed. The post-coup crackdown has exacerbated political polarization. And instead of uniting the country, events marking the anniversary of the coup are simply reminding people how divided it is. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
And just a reminder that you can always check out our website at dw.com for more content on the one-year anniversary of Turkey's failed coup. I'm Neil King in Bonn, Germany. Still to come on WorldLink, Muslims under threat in India and a unique 3D project in Israel that aims to humanize enemies. In India, many Muslims are feeling increasingly threatened following a spate of attacks over the past few months by Hindu vigilante groups who roam about highways inspecting livestock trucks for any trace of cows. Cows are considered holy by Hindus and are protected by law in many Muslim-majority Indian states. Hindu extremist groups have in the past lynched some Muslims who were accused of eating beef. The demonization of Muslims in the global war on terror has further fueled intolerance in a country where they make up about 14% of India's 1.3 billion population. DW correspondent Murali Krishnan met up with some of them to get a first-hand account of their anxieties in the world's largest democracy.
Zafar Aga, a journalist and a former member of the National Commission for Minority Educational Institutions, has just returned from a demonstration in the capital. The Not In My Name rally, organized by civil society groups, was a protest against targeted lynchings and against a spate of violent attacks across the country targeting the Muslim minority. Having chronicled political events for over 3 decades, for the first time in his career, Zafar is worried and agitated.
They're trying and testing, and in many sense, 10 years back, or rather 5 years back, nobody could have imagined that a Muslim would be lynched by a mob just because he's a Muslim. It's something unimaginable. It's a new experience altogether. I feel cheated. As a Muslim, I feel cheated.
Zafar is referring to the horrific murder of Junaid Khan, a 16-year-old Muslim boy who was stabbed to death on a train while he was returning home from Delhi last month. Khan was allegedly killed because of his Muslim identity. The teenager was thrown off the train after being stabbed by an unruly mob. It was one of the many lynchings and atrocities against Muslims in recent months. But what has led to this deep sense of insecurity among a huge swathe of Muslims?
Things have changed so dramatically in the last 3 years ever since Mr. Narendra Modi has become the Prime Minister of the country. There is a very concerted, organized campaign and effort to convert secular India into a majoritarian Hindu state. The minority, whether they are Muslims, Christians, they all feel insecure.
The fear runs high even in pockets of the country's rural hinterland. Some feel it is an undeclared emotional war. Malika Begum is a domestic help from the city of Kanpur in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, ruled by the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
For the first time this year, scores of Muslims across the country offered their Eid prayers while wearing a black band, a symbol of protest against growing atrocities against Muslims in the country. She also protested.
The Hindus, accuse us of eating beef and buffaloes. When they see us, we get beaten and they make life miserable for us. Look, Hindus also eat pork and other meats. Do we ever object to their eating habits?
Malika says the members of her family, which includes four daughters and a son, have just retracted to their shells.
We live in constant fear and we have to watch our backs all the time. It's their reign. We are not respected. And it's not getting better at all, especially in this current climate.
The attacks against Muslims are not just limited to suspicions of them eating beef or transporting cattle. Of late, so-called anti-Romeo squads have been formed that are meant to curb instances of sexual harassment of girls in Uttar Pradesh. They have morphed into vigilante gangs, attacking innocent civilians, mostly Muslim youth. Love Jihad is a term coined by right-wing Hindu outfits to highlight the alleged role of Muslim boys and men to convert women and girls belonging to various communities to Islam under the garb of love. Malika again.
I keep telling my children to be careful. The situation is bad. I tell them about the violence and how many Hindus want us to convert. They get scared when they go to school. They're afraid.
Clearly, there's a growing fear of living and traveling while Muslim in India, especially when it has emboldened many Hindus to reveal hidden prejudices. Zafar is disturbed by the trend.
Is it not amazing? Is it not frightening? Is it not disturbing? So there is a concerted effort to convert India into a Hindu state, which I feel is not disturbing only for the Muslims. Of course, it generates insecurity for the Muslims, but it is also disturbing lots and lots of Hindus as well.
Unfortunately, the lynchings have become the new normal. Though Prime Minister Narendra Modi has broken his silence twice in 3 years and condemned the killings in the name of protecting cows, it has not had any effect. Many feel that mere disapproval is not enough. Stern action is required. For now, all that matters to Muslims is to live without fear. Murali Krishnan, DW, New Delhi.
The veteran war photographer Ben Khalifa had a unique idea after covering numerous conflict zones around the world. He wanted to move beyond documenting the harsh realities of war. He wanted to actively change people's attitudes and perception of each other and break the vicious cycle of dehumanization that's created by war. So, for 3 years, he photographed, filmed, and interviewed fighters while collaborating with researchers at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. Ben, who divides his life between Berlin and Boston, used the newest virtual reality technology to create a holographic experience that brings home to the audience just how similar enemies are. The resulting installation is called The Enemy and was on show recently in Tel Aviv, Israel. Federica Sasso reports.
Hay muchas formas de definición de la paz. Lo que realmente ahora se quiere es una sociedad donde se pueda vivir bien.
The voices of the fighters reach me through the virtual reality headset. They're face to face, and I'm right in between, thanks to the visors that recreate them in full 3D. I can't get closer, take a look at their uniforms, study their tattoos, and we never lose eye contact. They are the avatar versions of the real fighters from El Salvador, Congo, Israel and Palestine, who agreed to collaborate with Belgian war photographer Karim Ben Khalifa for his project called The Enemy. It's an installation he's just presented at the International Student Film Festival in Tel Aviv, an immersive experience at the intersection of photography, virtual reality, neuroscience and storytelling. Ben Khalifa divides his life between Berlin and Boston after almost 20 years reporting from war zones.
I had the idea of The Enemy after the birth of my daughter when I was in Gaza, and I was with Islamic Jihad fighters in Orange Tree Field next to a hall that is half of this building. And I realized that I was putting my daughter in great danger. She was 3 weeks old. And I was tired of doing the same thing. I knew it was inefficient. And instead of doing what I was doing before, I started doing portraits. And I asked them 6 questions. And those 6 questions, you know, who's your enemy? Why did you ever kill him? What is violence for you? What is peace for you? And where do you see yourself in 20 years from now?
Then he did interviews with soldiers in Israel's defense forces, asking the same questions. That was the beginning, but Ben Khalifa knew that this was going to be bigger than Israel-Palestine, because, he says, the same thing happens in every war.
How you dehumanize the other. And I realized that I was with fighters on one side, but I was humanizing them, and then I was crossing the front line and going the other side and have the same experience. But they would deny this humanity from each other. And at that point, I thought it would probably be the most important story I could work on. How do I show humanity from both sides?
Ben Khalifa went on photographing fighters in other parts of the world, but he kept struggling with one question. What's the point of images of war if they don't change people's attitude toward armed conflicts and don't help create peace? He was also frustrated with the news cycle.
And I didn't want it to do the same thing. I didn't want it to go to those places, ship the photograph, see my photograph getting published. And yes, definitely the magazine that reached educated audience, powerful audiences. But that didn't bring change, not that I could see.
The turning point arrived in 2013 when he was invited as an artist in residence at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the US. It was there that he discovered virtual reality and had vertigo.
I was sitting on a chair in an office discovering virtual reality. I was on the side of a mountain. I looked down and I had vertigo. And so I removed the helmet and I understood that that medium was tricking my mind. So I walked out and then suddenly I had another idea. I said, what happened if the people that I have in photographs would actually be in a room? What happened to journalism when you add body language?
So he decided to explore, and The Enemy became a transmedia project. For 3 years, Ben Khalifa photographed, filmed, and interviewed fighters, while collaborating with researchers at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. Thanks to the newest virtual reality technology, the materials gathered in the field became an immersive experience that allows the audience to see how much enemies have in common with each other.
Only when both of them are answering, you can realize how similar they are. The way they envision peace, the way they see the future, the way they perceive their own enemy. So instead of trying to fix a conflict, why don't we go back to the basics? And if you can bring back humanity, to some extent you stop the war. Then the intervention and the journalism brings an information that actually changed the way you perceive the other. In the case of The Enemy, my audience is the next generation of fighters.
The project will soon be expanded to North and South Korea and Kashmir, but the first result is an installation that allows the audience to interact with fighters from gangs in El Salvador, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and Congo. Soon, an application will make it possible for the public to recreate the experience through their smartphones. But visitors at the Tel Aviv International Student Film Festival in June had the chance to meet the enemies face to face in their virtual reality personas. During shifts of about an hour, five people at the time were equipped with small backpacks and virtual reality headsets, allowing them to interact with six fighters, two for each conflict zone.
He found himself alone at 11, in a country that was hostile to his presence.
Moving around a bare, silent room, users, wearing visors, see the man enter the virtual room. They are life-size, they greet the users and look at them. It really feels like being in front of a person, an individual with their own mannerisms and body language. The interactions are personalized thanks to a questionnaire filled in beforehand, where the audience is asked to list their personal beliefs about war and their knowledge about the specific conflicts.
It's very real. It's you feel empathy to the person because it's so real.
The technology was interesting, even more than the contents.
Candice, an Israeli originally from South Africa, just visited the installation a second time together with a relative.
I think the key element is how you can use the narrative by use of technology and through that actually shift a change in people.
This is Karim Ben Khalifa's final goal, shifting narrative through an experience.
You make sense of the world through stories, and we all remember the world through experience. So what happened when you tell a story and it becomes an experience? Is this something that's going to help you change perceptions, make a step towards the other?
He hopes so, and plans on using this piece of journalism as a tool for reconciliation, and even just starting conversations with the people who come to experience his work at festivals. People like Roni, an Israeli who lives in the settlement of Elkana and is not convinced by the interview Ben Khalifa recorded with the fighter in Gaza.
Hard to convince me. I would need further proof that things not just between the soldiers, or between just the daily living people that are just normal people, that they really are, want the same, are the same, but what can they do? That's the problem. I'm sure if you had to get to the people would want the same.
Thank you very much. It's very important for me to disagree. I've never said this is going to bring peace.
But it brings and it triggers
a conversation. Thank you very much for coming.
Federica Sasso for W in Tel Aviv.
And that wraps up our first half of the programme. I'm Neil King, your WorldLink host. Just a reminder that you can always check out our Global Society Facebook page if you want to put faces to some of the people featured on WorldLink. Time for a music break now before we head into the second half of the programme. You're listening to DW's WorldLink with me, Neil King. Coming up, a special in-depth report on one of the world's most powerful organised criminal groups. The 'Ndrangheta is a mafia organisation centred in the southern Italian region of Calabria. It's hard to nail down just how large the group is because it is secret, but Europol says it's one of the richest crime rings on earth. A US diplomat was once quoted as saying the net worth of the 'Ndrangheta would account for around 3% of Italy's GDP. With power and money, of course, come danger for all involved. For generations, children of 'Ndrangheta families have been trained from an early age to continue the criminal business of their clan, with no other options. But an initiative started by a local judge has begun to change the fate of some of these children. In the past few years, more than 30 at-risk minors have been removed from their Ndrangheta families by juvenile courts. The children were placed in families in other parts of Italy to give them the chance to grow up safely. By now, some parents have begun to cooperate as well, but it remains a dangerous program for those involved in it. Reporter Jan Christoph Kitzler met some of those trying to change the fate of the children of Ndrangheta clans. His report is presented by Sue Bonnie Cox.
This is a story in which the main characters cannot speak. Teenagers, some of them still children, who are adjusting to a new life under the protection of the state, anonymously in secret locations. Their fathers, brothers, or uncles are often in jail, on the run, or dead. Their mothers have sometimes had the courage to rebel, and some have paid a high price for it. This is a story of a new kind of battle against the mafia, or more precisely, the 'Ndrangheta in Calabria, southern Italy. Anyone linked to it is involved in one of the most powerful organized crime networks in the world. According to a 2014 study, the 'Ndrangheta has an annual turnover of 53 billion euros, mainly from drug trafficking, weapons dealing, and illegal waste disposal. About 60,000 people in 30 countries are implicated in its business. But the 'Ndrangheta remains deeply rooted in Calabria. The clan's families are its power base. They stick together. Whoever wants to defeat the 'Ndrangheta from the outside has no chance. At least, that's how it's been until now. Because families not only stick together, they grow. There is always another generation to carry on the clan's traditions. Reggio Calabria. More than 180,000 people call this city home. An estimated 10% of them have links to the 'Ndrangheta of one kind or another. Most of the small businesses here pay protection money. There is little resistance from civil society. Mimmo Nazzoni is one of the very few to have taken a public stand against the mafia. The religious education teacher used to be a priest, but wound up getting married. He became involved in the Libera Anti-Mafia organization, where he's responsible for youth, justice and prisons. He knows only too well how the clan always has fresh blood.
Those born into these families are coerced from their childhood years to live the life of mafiosi. They grow up with the mafia's values: secrecy, violence, vengeance. They're taught to be on guard at all times, but the powerful mafia bosses in particular live in luxury without having to sweat for it. You live in wealth that you've never had to work for. You live this way and are shaped by it.
That means the boys of the 'Ndrangheta families find their upbringing totally normal. And those who are convicted of offences, who have to go to prison, normally end up becoming even more tightly bound to this life of crime. Mimmo Nazzoni has long taught the children of mafia bosses, and he hasn't found punishment to be very effective.
When they wind up in jail, it's an accolade for them. Recently, there were mafiosi who celebrated their release from prison with fireworks. There is no shame in it. It's as though they had graduated from university with a master's degree. And once you've spent a couple of years inside and stayed loyal to the clan, not collaborating with the justice system, you move up the hierarchy.
It looks like a losing battle. Roberto Di Bella has fought this battle for a long time. He too has learned that the problems begin early. He has worked in juvenile justice for 20 years, 15 of them in Reggio Calabria. For some time now, he has been chief of the youth court.
Negli ultimi vent'anni, il Tribunale per I minorenni di Reggio Calabria.
In the past 20 years, the Reggio Calabria Youth Court has held more than 100 proceedings for organized crime, including more than 50 cases of murder or attempted murder. Members of the 'Ndrangheta families from this region who committed crimes as minors, now as adults, they have more severe prison conditions. They've been killed in 'Ndrangheta feuds, or they've taken over the leadership of their family.
Di Bella's court has convicted minors who had already killed for their clan, for example, murdering policemen. Among them are the children or younger siblings of those who stood before the same court 10 or 20 years earlier. 'Ndrangheta membership is passed on through the generations, and the next generation is trained from an early age.
Situations have come to light in which minors are harmed. We've heard of parents who teach their 10 or 11-year-old children to shoot, even with military weapons. When we hear of such incidents, we intervene immediately, because there are certain situations we cannot tolerate.
Certain situations. Giuseppe Lombardo knows about these. He lives the kind of life familiar to many who fight the mafia. Guarded round the clock, moving only with an escort. His office is in the high-security Reggio Calabria Justice Complex. Lombardo is an anti-mafia public prosecutor. He has been for years. The clan has constantly tried to intimidate him. He once received a letter containing ammunition shells, and he's had death threats by phone. But Lombardo doesn't believe the 'Ndrangheta can be defeated with ever more pressure and punishment. You have to start with the families, he says.
I must intervene as early as possible. I can't wait until I'm facing the offender's son. We're always convicting the same people over and over again. That is not a victory. It's a defeat, because it means we haven't achieved anything. It means that even prison hasn't done anything, because after 10, 15 years, they're back again. The greatest defeat, though, is when you first try the children, then the grandchildren, and then the great-grandchildren.
Together, Lombardo, the public prosecutor, Di Bella, the juvenile court judge, and a few others, developed a concept which has changed the course of the battle against the 'Ndrangheta clan. They still hunt the big bosses, work to solve violent crime and cut the clans off from their economic base by confiscating their assets. But now they also have another approach.
We suggested to the federal prosecutor and the juvenile court that all the evidence, which up until then was only collected for criminal cases in order to reveal the organizational structures of the mafia organizations, should also be used to protect minors. The attorney general at the time accepted this. He called the juvenile court, leading to this tremendously important measure being taken for the first time.
That was a couple of years ago. Journalist Angela Iantosca has been researching the clan since well before then. In a busy cafe in central Rome, she talks about the books she's written, which tell the stories of 'Ndrangheta women and children. She's observed how the path is already clear for even the very young, and how difficult it is to draw them away from it.
Già le scuole medie in certi territori è tardi.
In some regions, by the time the children reach middle school, it's already too late, because by then the children are already trained for war. I remember this one boy, he spoke no Italian, spoke Calabrian only with difficulty. Actually, he pretty much just growled. I asked him how he saw his future, and without speaking, he just crossed one wrist over the other, like he was in handcuffs. He was only 11 years old.
One of her books is titled Bambini a Metà, which translates roughly to half children. What Iantosca has seen of clan families has little to do with normal childhood.
We're talking about children, or people who have never been children, who at 14 have been charged with murder, attempted murder, aggravated robbery, extortion, possession of loaded weapons with serial numbers removed. They're obviously about to commit a crime. Or who have, for example, vandalised police cars as a first offence.
It's been a few years since the first time authorities tried a new approach in the fight against the 'Ndrangheta. The boy was 16 when he was brought before the juvenile court. Roberto Di Bella had already dealt with his older brother. This boy belonged to one of the most powerful 'Ndrangheta families. His father had been murdered. Many of his other relatives were either dead or in jail. This boy was the beginning. This was the first attempt to take a child away from their family, to break the cycle of one generation taking over the dirty business of the last. Roberto Di Bella, the chief of the juvenile court, says it was necessary for the child's well-being.
Over the past 3 years, we've changed our procedure. In cases where it's clear that minors are harmed, we withdraw child custody from the mafia bosses and we take the children out of their families. So it is not that we intervene just because the family is part of the mafia, but rather when the mafia's educational methods pose a concrete danger to the psychophysical development of that child.
This has now been done about 30 times. Again and again, Di Bella has dealt with boys whose fate seemed predetermined. It's not only children from the city of Reggio Calabria, but also from small barren villages under the 'Ndrangheta's influence. From the mountains around Locri, for example, or the lowlands around the harbour town of Gioia Tauro. Children who, Di Bella says, have been abused and therefore need to be protected by the judiciary.
These children have no childhood. They're wearing an emotional straitjacket. They're used to hiding their feelings so as not to expose themselves or others. Very often, they're lonely. They don't have a father with whom they can share their everyday life experiences because he's either been killed, he's in jail, or he's a fugitive. The family puts intense pressure on its members to ensure security and enforce rules, completely ignoring the psychological well-being of their children and the suffering of the young people.
These children and youths must be taken away from their families, says juvenile judge Di Bella. They need to learn that there's a different life out there. The ferry takes about half an hour to cross the strait from Villa San Giovanni to Messina on the island of Sicily. A short journey into another world. Enrico Intodonato is waiting at the boat's destination. A psychologist in his early 30s, Intodonato is the founder of Addio Pizzo Messina. The organization fights protection payments the mafia imposes on Sicilians. Addio Pizzo's headquarters is close to the harbour.
This building, the office of Addio Pizzo, was confiscated. To be precise, it was the first building in Messina to be taken away and used for a social project. It was an apartment which was taken from a man who, by the way, still lives next door, Mr. Solli. He owns the building and runs a cultural association nearby. He was arrested for racketeering.
Enrico Intodonato looked after the first boy taken away from an 'Ndrangheta family. He still cares for other youths.
The government has a responsibility to intervene in situations like these, because these families are abusing their children. They are mentally abusing them, exposing them to great danger. Because when you show them how to use guns and how to cut cocaine, you are really abusing your children.
The youths he takes care of are traumatized. Many of them have suffered greatly. However, when they arrive in his care, they're generally not happy to be forced away from their families by judicial order. There's a lot of resistance, especially because in the 'Ndrangheta culture they were brought up in, the state is cast as an enemy.
For these youths, the state is seen as the one who comes at night and searches the house. that enters with guns and balaclavas and takes away the father. In regions like Calabria, there's a huge amount of antagonism between the state institutions and the criminal groups. We have the chance to show them that the state is made up of people.
To show the youths a different world, a different state, that's the aim. And it only works on a very personal level, through many conversations, through therapy, and experiences that allow mafia children to rediscover themselves. Taking part in theatre performances, for instance, with new friends who don't know that their family names signify belonging to an 'Ndrangheta clan, a stigma in Calabria.
I like to use this image to explain our work. The police infiltrate the 'Ndrangheta with undercover agents. We are doing the opposite. We introduce the youth incognito to the anti-mafia world. This gives them a fresh chance without anyone recognizing their family names. They can be free and spontaneous.
And hopefully they will eventually be able to make their own choices, because now they know there's an alternative, which they once had no inkling of. Part of the programme also involves debates with people who fight against the mafia. The youths are brought together with victims, people whose lives have been made difficult because they spoke out against the clans, people who have lost loved ones. Enrico Interdonato has seen how thought-provoking these encounters can be for 'Ndrangheta children. He's also experienced situations that were quite absurd.
We were travelling outside Messina to a conference against protection racketeering. The people there were salesmen who refused to pay protection money and made reports. We were sitting in a car with a witness. He'd had a security escort until 2 months before. The boy said to the witness, "Let's hope they don't commit an attack on us today." He just said it thoughtlessly, but he was talking about his world.
And what will become of these young people? As soon as they turn 18, they've reached the legal age of adulthood, and the programme ends. Many of the young men return to their families. It's a risk that Interdonato and his colleagues try to minimise by keeping in touch with them and helping them to find work, preferably outside Calabria. So far, about 30 'Ndrangheta children have been taken away from their families. The results of the programme are encouraging. All of them continued with their studies. All have at least the notion that it's possible to have a life which is different from the one they seem to be destined for.
Making your own choice means that you may, or rather you must, love your father, even if you have to visit him in jail every month. Even if he killed someone, he will always be your father. I know that you love him, and that's right. But it's not written down anywhere that you have to end up like him.
Just recently, one of the boys Interdonato looked after moved back to Calabria. How is he getting on there?
We've been talking on the phone, and I visited him a few months ago. He's about to graduate from high school. We spoke to his father, an ex-convict, 100% member of the 'Ndrangheta, and he told me, "Don't forget my son."
That's the aim of the project, to make parents understand and want to rescue their children from the vicious cycle of crime responsible for so many deaths and so many years spent in jail. Such understanding fathers are rare. But over the past few years, there have been several mothers who wanted to quit the mafia themselves. This was the case with the first boy in the programme, journalist Angela Iantosca says.
It is easier if the mother is a widow, as in their first case. If she wants to save her son, maybe it's her only son. Perhaps she's tired after 20 years of living with death, with children in jail. Perhaps she hasn't touched her son in 20 years. a mother filled with bitterness who decides to cooperate and who asks the court to help get her son out of the mafia.
That's no easy task. Breaking out of the clan can be life-threatening. Lia Garofalo, for example, was murdered in November 2009. She wanted a better life for her daughter Denise and reported her husband, Ndrangheta clan boss Carlo Cosco, to the police in Milan. Giuseppina Pesce is alive but lives under police protection and a new name. Her testimony has put several members of the Ndrangheta behind bars, among them her mother and her sister. Maria Concetta Cacciola tried to bring her family to court too and went into hiding. But then she wanted to see her children who had stayed with their grandparents. She fell into a trap. She was forced to drink hydrochloric acid to make her death look like suicide. Perhaps also due to the fear of violence, there are still too many women who stay with their mafia families and take an active role, juvenile judge Roberto Di Bella says.
Some of the mothers of these youths we take care of cannot be convinced. They keep indoctrinating their children. While their husbands are in prison, they're in charge, making sure the values of the clan are respected. Other mothers of those we look after are tormenting themselves and mourning their dead.
There appears to be a small, fragile trend that offers hope. Mimo Nazoni from the anti-mafia organization Libera explains.
Over these past few years, something revolutionary has happened. Some mothers or wives of those mafiosi from mafia families have become plagued by conscience. They have already paid a high price, because many of the mafia marriages are not love matches. They are often arranged between different mafia families in order to form new alliances and expand their influence. Some mothers decide their children shouldn't experience the same kind of violence they went through.
Anti-mafia public prosecutor Giuseppe Lombardo knows from his investigations that both women and children suffer in the clans. He hopes that they could be the key to a new fight against the mafia.
The women will push for a mechanism that will also convince many husbands, those who have not yet received criminal convictions, to break with their mafia connections. That is the goal. We want to trigger a moment of rebellion within the families. The wife needs to tell her husband, if you keep on doing what you're doing, you will not only be in jail for 15 or 20 years, but you will also lose custody of your children. Is it really worth it?
Giuseppe Lombardo has already received messages from some mafia bosses. They've let him know that taking their children away from them bothers them greatly, a way of saying that in their eyes, he's gone too far. For Giuseppe Lombardo, it proves he's on the right track. Being a public prosecutor, he frequently deals with arrests and confiscations in the fight against the 'Ndrangheta. But he also sees that these measures have a limited impact. He believes the families need to be the new focus of the anti-mafia battle.
If there was well-thought-out supervision and monitoring, many of the court cases could be avoided. The state needs to regain some of the sensitivity that has been lost in the course of the long fight against the mafia. First and foremost, it is a cultural and social problem, and only secondly, a criminal problem. But that doesn't make for much of a headline.
Ma non può essere uno slogan giornalistico.
Roberto Di Bella, the chief of the juvenile court, is working against many odds. What he does is still in the experimental phase. His colleagues are still skeptical. But for him, it is all about protecting children and youths.
Yes, every child has the right to be brought up by their own parents. That is a basic right. But it is not an absolute right. It needs to be well considered, and from time to time, it needs to be sacrificed for the sake of a different right, which is also a basic right, the right to be brought up in a responsible manner.
That is why it's important that the judge's orders to withdraw child custody really improve the well-being of the children, says journalist Angela Iantosca.
If the 'Ndrangheta families understand that this measure is being taken for and not against something, if mothers understand that it serves to save their children and that it is not a measure taken against organised crime, then it is less threatening for them. The juvenile court's goal is not to fight the mafia, it wants to save the children.
In recent years, religious education teacher Mimo Nazone has seen that law enforcement alone is ineffective. Young men from clan families in particular need prospects for their own lives outside the criminal world.
The obstacles need to be removed, and they cannot be removed by arresting many mafiosi and corrupt people. You also need to create alternatives. If a mafioso is released from prison and wants to live an honest life, it is very difficult under the current conditions. That is the main weakness.
Psychologist Enrico Interdonato says the state needs to engage more on this issue. Until now, only a few dedicated people care for 'Ndrangheta children on a voluntary basis. To win this fight, more is needed.
At the moment, we are all volunteers. We're improvising. But honestly speaking, we have reached a point where we cannot improvise anymore. It's been 4 years now since the first judicial order. We've gained a lot of experience, and we can now say we have an idea of what we need and what the needs of these youths are, where we need to invest. We've written everything down in black and white. I don't know, what lacks is the political will.
Manca, non so, la volontà.
Thanks there to Sue Cox, presenting that report by Jan-Christoph Kitzler. We're going to switch gears a bit for our last report and head to the German capital. That Berlin has been on a development highway for the past two decades can surprise nobody. But in and amongst that urban evolution are reminders, great and small, and sometimes even tiny, of the past. And in some places, old and new are so at odds with one another that they strike an atonal note, which, as our regular Worldling columnist Tamsin Walker reluctantly admits, can, if you really pay attention, have a charm of its own.
There's a place I pass regularly, and yes, I am a creature of habit, where visual and acoustic poetry are hard at work. A small-scale 21st century Sinfonie der Großstadt, or Symphony of a Metropolis. Or at the very least, a movement, featuring nothing less than a chorus of pigeons and cranes, as in birds, and big tools. In a red wooden hut bearing the words Flying Tippler, in reference to the species inside, 50 or so birds coo to themselves, each other, and whoever happens to be passing by.
Come rein, come, get rein.
Their keeper, or fancier, as they are oddly yet officially called, is Bosnian Cemzo Enet Fekica, also known as Nico.
Ich habe immer geguckt an Tauben.
When he came to Germany in 1991, he carried with him a fascination for pigeons that he'd been nurturing since he was a boy. In the early days of reunification, he bought some birds and a hut, which he put down on what until shortly beforehand had served as the death strip dividing East and West Berlin. And they're still there, a tiny red loft where pigeons are bred to do things of which we Homo sapiens can but dream. Just meters behind it is another red construction, an elaborate makeshift archway to a whole different breed of dream. The wording on it reads, so inviting, so Berlin, so home, so Berlin. Yeah, you get the picture. The hard sell for hundreds of new flats and the unmistakable rhetoric of investors driving the German capital down avenues still in the making. When the site was first cleared, uprooting old fruit trees and a hard-fought battle with locals, I felt that familiar pang of nostalgia for the slower-paced Berlin, in which residents set up higgledy-piggledy bars, urban gardens and performance venues on disused space. The Berlin which investors had yet to colonise. All the more meaningful, then, that the Pigeon Loft is still there. It's a glimpse of the magical among the increasingly ordinary. For the birds, under Nico's guidance, are capable of incredible feats.
Ich habe Rekord, deutsche Rekord bei mir.
In 2012, he and one of his pigeons broke the German record, and they still hold it. To be honest, hand on heart, ignorance on the table, I had no idea if flying tipplers were racing or homing pigeons. As it happens, they're neither.
Die fliegen non-stop oben, keine Pause. 20 Stunden, 45 Minuten.
They're endurance birds, Nico told me, which means they fly around in the same general area for as long as their wings will carry them. One of his made it into the history books by circling the skies above its hut for 20 hours and 45 minutes, non-stop. And he narrowly missed out on the world record last month. But he's quietly hopeful for next year.
Come, get in.
To that end, every day after his shift working as a nurse for the elderly, he comes down to the Red Hut to train and tend the birds that have captivated him since those early days back in Bosnia. His tipplers know who he is and do exactly what his gentle whistles and whispers tell them to. I'm amazed that they can hear anything above the din of the building site, but clearly they can. Nico's pleasure is visible in his smile.
Ich konnte nicht ohne Tauben hier, ja.
I couldn't be without pigeons, he told me. Just watching them makes him happy. And as we sat on a small triangle of grass on that former death strip, Nico, every now and then casting his gaze upwards to one of his flock, the constructions rising up beside us, ceased to seem so singularly invasive, becoming instead just a bit part in this atonal 21st century movement of a metropolis.
And that takes us to the end of this week's show. Thanks a lot for listening to the personal stories behind the headlines on Worldlink. You'll find photos and videos from some of our reports on our DW Global Society Facebook page. And if you'd like to be in touch with your feedback or questions, drop us an email to worldlink@dw.com. To find all our episodes online, go to dw.com/worldlink, look up DW English on SoundCloud, or check us out on iTunes. This week's show was produced by Gabriel Borrud and me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Christoph Grover. Worldlink was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.